This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about public speaking as a factor in mental health with comedian Vic Slayton. And first off, I've got some background information. The National Institute of Mental Health reports that the fear of public speaking is the most common phobia ahead of spiders, heights, or even death. The underlying fear for this is usually judgment or negative evaluation by others. And public speaking anxiety can also be part of a social anxiety disorder. So, loads to unpack there. First off, incredible what it said about this being even more common than fear of spiders, which we, you know, if you think of phobias, spiders is often one the first you think of, heights as well, and even death. Looking into the general research on this, there are some theories on why that's the case, because, you know, you'd naturally assume, are there many things more fearful than death? But some of the theories I found on why that is in terms of our kind of survival instincts. You know, we understandably have survival instincts about death, but we also have survival instincts around isolation and rejection. Being part of a group is not only something that can be safe, you know, historically, but very much in today's world, there's those are situations where you're safer in a group. But also, I think as we've all experienced to an extent in the pandemic, isolation is a threat to us in so many ways and very much a threat to our mental health. And so that's quite incredible to think that being rejected and being, what's the word? Yeah, ridiculed, exiled. That's the word I'm looking for. Being exiled, I think, is a big part of this fear, which maybe does make sense. Because if you think even when I think about people in my own life who have known that they're reaching the end of their life, a big part of the worry about that is, will my family be around me? You know, even then, it's not just the end of the life. It's the, am I going to get to say goodbye? Am I going to have company there at the end? Do I get that reassurance from the people that love me?
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think maybe why people are so fearful of it, of public speaking, as opposed to like more so than death, which is, it isn't really that surprising because I think with death, although there's so much anxiety that may come with it, it can often feel, you know, distant. Those with anxiety about it can maybe put it away and deal with now. Well, that's what we might support people to do, you know, put those thoughts to the side, unless you know that you're coming to the end of your life through an illness or something. You can generally put that to the side. In public speaking, that feeling, that overwhelming adrenaline and anxiety that kicks in that moment before you're about to go on stage or whatever it is, can be absolutely debilitating, can't it? Like, you know, I've seen people, and me too, you know, where you just, like, sweaty, all the physical things that happen, your sweaty palms, your heart rate, all of that that's associated with anxiety can be so overwhelming. And it is because, like you said, primarily because what people think, what you think people might think, which one you have no control over when we think about it logically, and two, you're probably never going to know. I mean, in today's world of social media, you know, people can instantly respond to things, don't get me wrong. But, you know, in that moment, when you're going into it, it's unlikely. I mean, I'm thinking of the workplace because that's where it happens for me. So I'm not going to get like booed and like ridiculed in that moment like you might do, you know, I don't know, in a football stadium or something. You know, the workplace is generally quite professional, so no one's going to like start really like hollering at me. But we don't have any control over what people are going to think of us, but yet we lead with that cripples us, really.
Right, and I think that is something that all of us can relate to. We've all had that experience at some point, that really intense fear. And that's why it's kind of a tricky topic, actually, to get statistics on, right? That we understand the link to mental health is so clear. You know, particularly the link between this specific anxiety and then if you have that alongside other anxieties, or if you have that frequently enough, then that can cross over into an anxiety diagnosis. But one thing I do want to flag up with this research that I mentioned, that glossophobia affects 73% of the population, according to the National Institute of Mental Health. I just wanted to say that that is self-reported. So that was a big research survey they did. And so perhaps because this is such a relatable experience for people, it's very easy to tick yes to having that. But sometimes we can have this risk that we also have with mental health conditions, where just because elements of it are relatable doesn't mean that everybody's experience is the same, right? That difference between experiencing anxiety and having anxiety. And so that 73% having a specific phobia does still feel quite high to me as someone who, you know, my understanding of phobias is that's when it's a fear that is interfering with your daily life, you know, is at that level, and or is causing, like you described, a complete like panic and debilitating fear when you come across it. And I don't know if that's maybe 73% of people's experiences to that extent, but it does highlight how this is such a massive issue. And I wonder if to an extent people are aware of that, because another stat we found from Columbia University was that only 8% of people experiencing fear of public speaking seek professional help. And maybe that's part of the reason why, because it can be easy to think, oh, well, we all have this and everyone else copes with it. But that doesn't mean that some people don't need extra support.
Yeah, Bobby, absolutely. Great point. Where we cross the line between, do we just tick if we ask a random population if you fear public speaking and they said yes, as opposed to it being, you know, that crossover into it being like a phobia. And it's the same with that 8%. Is that 8% those who do it at a very high level where I have to seek professional help for this because it's my job, it's what I love to do, but some of my own anxieties really kick in and it's really stopping me from doing what I love to do. So I go then and seek professional help rather than just, you know, Joe Blogs on the street, only 8% of a population go and seek professional help, because why would you if it wasn't something that you did in your day-to-day world or life, or, you know, quite often. So yeah, that interests me. Those statistics are really interesting.
Right. And I just want to pause on that, actually, because I think that really highlights the guest's experience that she talks about. So much of what held her back with this particular fear and with the anxiety around it for her was it felt easier to avoid those situations than it did to tackle the problem. And as we know, with many things in mental health, that often isn't a solution in itself, you know. And certainly from my own experience, I found that often when you avoid something that causes you distress, other things pop up. It's almost like the distress, if it's to do with your mental health, you might be able to run from the situation, but that's not as easy as running from what's going on in your mind.
Oh, well, what a great point. But in the moment, sometimes that just, we don't seem, doesn't feel like that. It doesn't feel like we want to do that. So we bury our heads, I guess, a little bit for that reason. But it goes back to, again, that same thing. You know, when we talk about fear of something, are we actually like, you know, I was with the children over Easter and they went to a Go Ape thing, you know, where you're climbing through the trees on rope swings and all that stuff. And they love it. And there was a family that we were talking to and they were saying, oh, I'm so scared of heights. And it's not the fear of a height. It's a fear of falling. You know, it's not the fear of swimming. I'm scared of the sea. You're scared of maybe drowning. I'm not scared of speaking in public. What does public speaking mean? Like speaking to a group of people. We're scared of what might happen because of that. And so sometimes we get a bit fixated, and to hear this family speaking quite openly with their children and in front of their children and say, oh, he's scared of heights. I don't like heights, so I'm not surprised my son's scared of heights. And I'm sat there, you know, obviously in my psychology head, I'm thinking he's not scared of the height. He's scared of falling. So reassuring that you're not going to fall, because there's no way you can, because this rope we've just been told can hold an elephant and your six-year-old child. You know, we can, and fair enough, that may be something that this child needs to get over and doesn't want to do. It's not about forcing them to do it, but it's about recognizing and acknowledging what the fear is, where the fear is coming from, rather than labeling it, I'm scared of heights, I'm scared of public speaking, I'm scared of dogs. No, you're scared of what you think will happen if you interact with a dog, that it might bite you.
I think that's brilliant, because that's such a big part of unpacking it. You know, I would describe that as finding, you know, the consequence, like the thing that you're scared of could be described as the consequence, because otherwise it can just follow you around. You know, if you're scared of the rejection threat that public speaking is in your mind, well, then avoiding that, you're not going to necessarily be able to avoid other possible rejections in your life. You know, then what, do you rule out dating? You know, do you rule out applying for a job? Like, how far does that go before there comes a point when you need to address it? And I think you having that intense urge to avoid something, maybe in the short term, sure, but perhaps in the longer term, that is going to catch up with you. And so it was interesting to hear the guest getting to that point. And not only did she get there, but trying to tackle that fear of public speaking head on ended up being her route into comedy. And that's so powerful to hear. And actually, we have some stats that really link to that idea of these issues following you around, because we're aware of like the secondary impacts of mental health. You know, there can be the what I would describe as the primary. So, you know, this situation could cause anxiety with you. And if, let's say, you are someone that has this fear and you have a job where speaking publicly is a big part of it, that could be enough that your symptoms are enough to be diagnosable as an anxiety condition, for example. But there are also these secondary impacts. So the Columbia University again found some stats that there are all kinds of impacts this can have on your life. So they found that this could impact your wages by as much as 10% on average, your likelihood of completing a degree by 10%, your chances of obtaining a managerial or other leadership position, 15%. And so there's all these secondary impacts that you not speaking up could hold you back on, right? And it's really shocking to see those, but then you think about it and that just makes sense, because being one of the ones that really speaks up in the meetings is the kind of thing where people are like, oh, leadership abilities, right? You know, you talking about, here are the things I've done this week, in like a team huddle, or when you're talking to your manager and you speak up about, oh, here's some stuff I've recently achieved. Are they going to factor those things into your bonus at the end of the year? I can see it, definitely. And so, yeah, it's nice to have this example of a clear secondary link with mental health as well, how this can affect your life in a more general sense that can also affect how you're doing. And we don't always have stats like that. So it's nice to have them here. And so I really found this interview really empowering. Vix is so funny, such a delight to talk to. And I think gave a lot of really practical advice on how to overcome these fears and all the unexpected benefits she found. You know, she went into it for one reason and she found out, ooh, maybe this adrenaline, this can be channeled into something good.
I know, it's amazing. Really interesting story, but great episode.
So with that all said, we'll get into this episode with Vix Leighton in a moment. And as usual, if you want to hear me talk to more comedians, do check out our other podcast, Dating Games, where we talk all about relationships, particularly now that things are starting to lift a little bit and dating is looking a lot more possible. You have more options, should I say, on how to date people. So yeah. Do check that out if you want more. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hi, I'm Vix Leighton and I am a rehabilitated childhood show-off. I was the kind of kid that, well, you probably call me a stage school kid, except my parents couldn't really afford to send me to any of the fancy stage schools. So I kind of made my own stage school inside my head. So I was doing a lot of producing. I had a video camera when I was a kid, and I did a lot of very low-tech Wallace and Gromit style stop motion animation. Wow. I put on my own shows. I did one, a really high concept production of The Ugly Duckling, where I was the writer, producer, star of the show, and I ran the raffle as well, which was an absolute racket of a raffle. Alan Sugar would have been proud of it. I got a fiver out of my mum and use it to buy prizes. I spent £3 on the prizes and drew my own ticket for the top prize, which was a box of Maltesers. So I was inseparable, I think. Had the karaoke machine out all the time. My mum was a karaoke queen, and she'd have people around every week. She was just the community hub, really. So I was a small child with a lot of adult company as an only child, which I think definitely helped me with the confidence that I initially had, but somewhere along the line, I lost it. And I can't point to a specific incident. I can't say I went up to speak one day and walked up to the mic and my top fell down and went full Judy Finnegan, bra out, mortified. Just, it was, yeah, more like a Japanese knotweed. I started to get quite nervous, just like low-level, normal amounts of nerves. So after GCSE drama, which I got a B, I nailed that, I started to get really nervous when I had to public speak, and it started to be a physical response. It went from just noise in my head, is this going to be okay, to my eyelid would start ticking, my leg would start shaking, I could hear the tremble in my voice. It was, yeah, psychosomatic, to be honest, and I just don't know where it came from. I feel like it's probably wrapped into some body image issues, because I guess the older you get, the more aware you are of who you are compared to other people. And I'd certainly picked that from my mum. And my mum had, I think, wanting the best for me, had seen that people who were slimmer tended to get further, and kind of instilled in me that I had a little bit of puppy fat to use. It was that kind of conversation that you'll get a lot from well-meaning people. And I became aware that I was one of the bigger ones out of my friendship group. Mm-hmm. And then I started to worry about people looking at me and wanting to control how I was perceived a little bit more. I've spent quite a lot of time psychoanalyzing myself.
I just wanted to ask you about the timeline on that. Was that quite gradual leading up to it? Like, how many years can you trace back that change starting to come from you being a boisterous little kid?
It started, I think, around A-levels time. I got through drama. I wasn't particularly any more nervous than anyone would be if they were going to perform like a GCSE drama piece to an audience. Like, it's natural to feel nerves for that, and that's what makes it so exciting. So up until then, I think I was kind of level with everybody else in terms of appropriateness to the situation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, my mental health started to generally decline at university. And I think it was symptomatic of that time. I remember being in a seminar, again, of like a really small group of peers on my university degree. And I was so stressed about it. And I spent days fixating, not on the content of it. I wasn't not confident that I had the right information to impart. Just the idea of being in front of people just really spun me out. And it just didn't get any better. Yeah, over time, it just escalated. And I stopped seeking out things to do of that nature. I stopped putting myself forward for things. I stopped volunteering. And when I had to do them, it became a huge issue.
It sounds like at the same time, not only were you building in fear to this, but also your reaction was building. Because I've heard you describe it where there was all of the physical symptoms you've described, but then it was getting to the point where you thought you were ill, but not mental health ill. You thought you were ill in terms of vomiting and have I got flu or something like that.
I genuinely thought I had norovirus before probably the biggest speaking engagement that I was racked up to do before I gave up and decided I wasn't going to put myself forward for any of that. And that was probably, I think I was about 26 or 27. And I'd agreed to take a social media coaching session for some people that were trying to upskill. It was a really cool idea. It was a local cause that I felt really strongly about. And I wanted to do it. Every bit of me wanted to be the person that did that. I knew I had the right skills, but I hadn't prepared for it either because I had this just emotional block about anything to do with it, which if I prepared for it, I could have rehearsed it and I might have got over it. But the more noise that built over it, like you referenced, the physical thing, but also the panic that these physical symptoms were occurring in me just built up into something that felt insurmountable. So when I woke up the day before and was being sick every 10 minutes, I was like, brilliant. It's got to be something like the norovirus, but this is legit. I can legitimately pull out. These are physical symptoms. I can't go now. I can't be sick all over those people. What am I going to do? As soon as I sent the email saying I couldn't do it, I stopped being sick. So I had built myself up in such a high state of anxiety. I had done. I don't need to be putting myself through this. Maybe I'm just not that person. And I just gave up on that element of my life. So I'd gone from being somebody who loved performing so much. I was going door to door selling tickets when I was 7 for my own production, to slamming the door on that and hoping that I never had to do anything more than a presentation and an interview ever again. Yeah. Which, yeah, the decline felt quite steep. But yeah, I just closed the door on it. I was like, I do not need to be putting myself through that.
Right. And you've really articulated so well there how generalized these fears can get, that it sounds like even the idea of prepping for the presentation then was prompting this level of anxiety. And so then you get scared of even doing that. So I can absolutely see how the most obvious solution was, okay, I have to rule all of this out because clearly I can't touch any part of it.
And people didn't understand it because I'm very outgoing in a one-to-one scenario. Mm-hmm. I'd be happy in a room, for example, at a party. I'm happy to tell a story to a group of people off the cuff in that kind of holding court way that you do when you're that kind of pub table raconteur. I love that stuff. As long as I was one-to-one and I was in control of it, I was fine. So trying to explain to people why I wouldn't come and speak at, you know, their local school, or I didn't want to go and do some stage stuff that my friend was producing, it was really hard for them to marry up the version of me they had in their head as one of the most confident people they knew with this terrible, crippling anxiety that I had to do anything like that. And so I just didn't talk about it. But it became so much bigger than it needed to be. And even having to say something at work, if I got called upon in a work meeting to talk about something that I'd done well, it would trigger all those symptoms almost immediately. The eyelid would be flickering, the leg would be going. And yeah, it was horrible. I didn't feel in control of myself. Yeah, it was horrible to see it manifest like that.
Right. And it's fascinating, isn't it, how it's not comparable. You know, it's like so many things when it comes to our mental health, people might think, oh, well, I'm fine with that situation and therefore you should be, or you're confident and therefore you should be confident in all elements. And it would be so much easier if life was that straightforward. Yeah. But whilst I've not had a fear of public speaking myself, even I feel this immense difference between, you know, chatting to a group of people. They don't even have to be people I know, but just having a group conversation versus going into, let's say, a new work environment and they say, okay, we're going to go around the table and you've got to give a fact about yourself. And suddenly I know nothing about myself. Something as small as that, the like additional level of structure, throws everything out the window. It doesn't matter if it's half the people. It's the fact that I'm going to see the turn coming round to me and I'm going to be comparing my answer with everyone else's.
Exactly that. And when I was forced to do something like that, it was just white noise in my head. I didn't know what was going on. It was like being drunk. I wasn't in control of what I was saying necessarily. It was just blurting out and it was coming out fine. So again, it felt like this weird humble brag to say to people after an event where I had to speak. That was really stressful. They're like, no, but you were great. You were really funny. It's like, but I didn't say any of the stuff that I'd prepared to say. Because I lost control of it and I panicked. I played to the audience enough that they didn't know, but I didn't necessarily get my points across. I just didn't feel in control. And yeah, it just sounds like a humble brag then. Like, oh, you didn't think you were going to be good and that was amazing. It's like, not for me. Not for me at all.
It's true though. You can get so disconnected and you're always comparing yourself, I think, to these mostly imaginary ideas of what it's going to be like. Because I get that even with, you know, if I go and be a guest on other people's podcasts, I find myself really comparing that. I don't so much when it's my own show, but when it's other people's, I'm like, oh, but I didn't give that interview as well as I gave an interview with another show. And I put it all on me as if it's not a different structure and a different host. And one was 6 months later when I'd worked more things out. We can, you know, hold ourselves to these impossible standards and then make comparisons that no audience is going to make.
Yeah. that was one of the most empowering things that I think comedy has taught me. And I was somebody, because I work in corporate PR and finance, and I was going to conferences constantly and complaining that all the speakers were male and they were boring. And they were, I called them male, pale and stale, because there was just no diversity in the panels that I was seeing whatsoever. But then I'd be asked to speak and I'd decline. So I was wondering, I was like, how many of us want change but can't, for whatever reason, see themselves as part of it? So I took a drunken New Year's resolution to get over this fear of public speaking and tackle it by signing up to do a stand-up comedy skills for business course. And it was a half-day thing, and it was expensive enough that I knew I would try my best to attend it, but not so expensive that if I bottled it, I would be in trouble. So that's how I got here. That's how it all began, on that half-day course. And right up until when I went to it, I wasn't sure I would get on the train to go to it or turn up. The only thing that pushed me to do it is I tweeted that I was doing it, because I like to hold myself to account by putting it on Twitter, because then somebody might ask me about it. And the idea that someone will ask me about it and I'll then have to say I bottled out, sometimes that's enough to push me to do things, even if it's like going to the gym or going for a run. I sometimes need somebody else to witness me so that in my mind I'm accountable to somebody. So that was, I think, the vibe when I tweeted that I was going to go and do it. And somebody from my hometown, because I'm from Cardiff, I live in London now, tweeted back that they'd signed up for it as well and they were traveling up to do it. And all of a sudden I had a friend in the class, because we tweeted back and forth enough. But I had someone who would notice that I wasn't there. And that was probably the thing that pushed me out of the front door, when otherwise I might have woken up that morning and thought, well, it's a rainy day. Maybe today's not the day, I'll tackle it another time. So I was really lucky that the right person was seeing that tweet at the right time to get me there. So
yeah, no, that's brilliant. And I totally get what you mean about the holding yourself accountable, because even when you mentioned about the money, that's the kind of thing I would do, where I'd be like, okay, this is expensive enough where I'm going to feel guilty. And it's this weird kind of externalizing we do, where for all the things we learn as young people, self-motivation isn't really one. And we're so used to being in working environments as well. You know, most of how the country is run is working environments where the fear is your boss is going to tell you off, or your colleagues are going to be let down. And so actually, even for those people that are always self-employed, I think learning to self-motivate is so difficult. And so sometimes we kind of have to cheat and be like, okay, I'm going to punish myself with, I will have wasted this money, or I'm going to make sure people know about this thing. And I kind of think, like, comedy in a way is a real example of that, where so many of the comedians I speak to, they have a level of obsession with their craft that's part of what makes them so good, but that wouldn't really exist unless it was an environment where they go out in front of people. So the very nature of them speaking publicly is the only thing that makes that level of effort make sense.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. But it was another thing as well, because I'm an avid podcast fan, and another thing that kind of inspired me out of the door, I think it was on Sophie Hagen's Mopod, and they were talking about going to the gym. Mm-hmm. And just breaking it down, just go and see how it feels. You can turn away at any point. Just because you go to the venue, and in this analogy it was the gym, just because you go there doesn't mean you have to work out. You just have to take that first step, get in there, see how it feels. If it's all right, take the next step. And I think in my mind, I could have turned away at the door, or I could have turned away at registration, and I kept that in mind. I didn't have to sit through the whole thing if I couldn't cope with it. And it's the same conversation I had when I had my tattoo. I had to keep reminding myself, I have chosen to do this. I'm not beholden to it. I could choose to walk away. And I kept that ticking over as I was getting the DNR.
It's a really difficult balance, that, though, isn't it? Because for the listeners, this is one of the reasons why this topic is so fascinating to me, is because it relates really closely to the fight or flight response that we talk about a lot, relating to anxiety in particular. So what you described of going blank on stage and, you know, sort of zoning out, and you say what you said, but you're not quite sure what you said. And that's quite a terrifying experience. A lot of that comes from a very biological place. As part of our fear response, we focus in a way which is very here and now. So you maybe have even experienced this on stage, where you think that your set's going badly and then suddenly you're really trying so hard to not focus on the audience and analyze who's not laughing. That person, are they awake? Are they asleep? You become so drawn into that. And what you don't become drawn into is your memories. They can actually become quite inaccessible to you because it's part of that like narrowing focus that you would need if you had to run away from someone. But the difference is that's triggered by a fear, which whilst the fear is genuine, the threat isn't. You don't actually have to run away from any of these people. No one's going to climb up on the stage and punch you because they don't find you funny. But if you trigger that fight or flight response, you can't help but be drawn into that of like looking around. Where do I find safety? Where do I find the threat?
And I guess the interesting bit of this, and what we can probably talk to that a bit later on, is the exact opposite that happened to me once I'd broken the back of it. So I went to the session and it was this revolutionary, really simple task, but revolutionary bit of thinking. We went around the circle and it was the classic, the horror show that, you know, everyone hates doing this. Think of something interesting about yourself to say that nobody would know about you from looking at you. And I was towards the end of it. And I was obsessed with what I was going to say.
What a question to make you self-conscious, right? And there's so many layers for how you would analyze yourself.
I'm wearing a red bra, or I was so stressed about it. And as we went around the circle, a lot of people were just sharing stuff. And I got to me and I got through it. All of my usual psychosomatic symptoms kicked in. And then the next part of the task was, now we're going to go back around the circle and you are going to be the person that went before you and you've got to tell me everything you remember about what they said. And obviously I could not remember a shred of what the person next to me had said because my mind had immediately gone to, what am I going to say? Mm-hmm. And we were told at the start, don't think about it, just say whatever comes into your head. And no one did that. So we were all trying to piece together what everybody else said. And we weren't listening. And the course tutor, Lynn Parker, said, if you've just been listening to other people and being an active part of the conversation, you wouldn't have wound yourself up into that state. You would have learnt a lot more about other people and you could have based your story on whatever this next to you said or riffed off them. How many of you just thought about your own thing and were all like putting our hands up like sheepishly? But it was just revolutionary thinking. That's the kind of thinking that I took into meetings where I had to speak. I was like, why don't I just pay attention to this until it's my turn rather than spending 20 minutes biting all the skin off my lip? And it's such a small thing, but it didn't change my thinking overnight, but it was always there in the back of my mind. It was like, oh, that was a choice that I made. It was a choice I made to fixate on my own 2 minutes rather than enjoy half an hour of something that would have been probably interesting and enriching. And I didn't do that. How much of my life have I lost to these situations? Yeah, it shook something loose in me and I really enjoyed it. And I was nervous still, but the more time I spent with people, and because I was with people, like-minded people at sort of different stages of what they wanted to get out of it, but like-minded people, I really enjoyed the set that we had to do at the end. I chose not to do a stand-up set because we all could do 5 minutes either as a sketch or a stand-up set. I wanted to do a stand-up set because I have loved comedy. I love comedians like most people love bands. Like, I can listen to their shows like favourite albums and I'll find something new in it each time. I love comedy. So I wanted to have a go, but I bottled it and ended up doing a sketch. And I was livid with myself. And I was like, right, maybe this is something that I should be exploring because I loved it. It was terrifying, but doing it anyway, even though it was scary, was a big psychological shift for me. I was like, wow, I really was scared of doing that. And I did it and it wasn't terrible. And at the end, Lynn, the course person, said, oh, what are you going to do about stand-up next? Because she just assumed that I was there because I was interested in comedy, not to get over a white-knuckle fear that had been dominating too much of my headspace. And it was just the start of something. And then I tweeted about it again, like I said. Sometimes I just like to ask the universe. So I tweeted and said, and put something on Facebook, say, oh, I'm interested in starting in comedy. Does anyone have any leads? How does one get started in comedy? Like, it was that easy. No one knew. Lots of people were like, yeah, we always thought you were funny. Loads of really empowering stuff from friends and family, but ultimately no. Practical lead at all. Just a lot of people agreeing that that's something that I should do. So I was already mentally putting that away. Like, look, I did all I could. I posted twice on 2 social media platforms. I've done all I can to pursue this. I can put this away now as something I didn't let go. I gave it a good try. And the comedian Mark Watson tweeted me back. and said he was doing a marathon show and he was asking people to do challenges. So he said, do you want yours to be learning stand-up in 26 hours? And he was my favorite, one of my favorite comedians. And when someone like that asks you to do something, you feel like you ought to do it. So I said yes and went through all those symptoms that we've described in the run-up to it. I managed to get, I think, about £1,000 worth of sponsorship from people who were really generous towards it. They wanted me to give it a go. And it was terrifying and scary to get onto the stage each time to check in with the audience, because I was just a part of the show. Loads of people were doing loads of different challenges, some of them on stage type challenges, some of them more like running, some was like doing a big 26 hour marathon run and walks, but mine was part of the show, which was really nice. So every time I got back up, I felt a little bit more confident. The first time the lights were on me, I didn't remember how my arms and legs worked. My top lip was stuck to my teeth. I was like, do I know words? It was horrible because I didn't get called up until a few hours in, because I was there for the full 26 hours. I didn't get called for a good few hours, and I'd really hoped that they'd forgotten about me. Like, I'd started to settle in. My heart rate had gone down. I'd started to settle in. I was enjoying everybody else's bits of the shows. So when I got called, there was a moment again where I thought, I could just not call back. I could just sort of roll away and like crawl off into the shadows. But wanting to be part of it, wanting to have a once-in-a-lifetime experience with a comedian that I really loved, overrode it enough. When I came off after the 26 hours doing all kinds of coaching and weird stuff with volunteers who helped me with everything from like writing my first 5 minutes to understanding that the audience wants you to do well, like everybody hopes for the best when you come on, like those kind of things that were common sense became the foundation of what I would look back on. And I did my first gig a couple of weeks after from somebody that I'd met at the marathon show. So I got booked for my first gig, did my first 5 minutes. The exhilaration of doing it and the adrenaline just carried me. Like, there were hardly any nerves at all because I was just giddy from the prospect of being booked to do comedy. Like, it was huge. It was something that I never thought was possible. Just by me being in front of people ticked such a big box of something I never thought I'd do, that however it went, I wasn't that bothered. It was just that I'd done it. It was amazing to be able to enjoy that element of it that a lot of people didn't enjoy. A lot of people who are starting an open mic, they've never been more nervous. Whereas for me, I was like, I cannot believe I'm doing this, guys. Did you see me? I was on the stage. I did it. I was there for 5 minutes. But it swung back around now, funny enough. And the more I worked at it, the more I wanted to be good. And the more that the anxieties come back in a way that I hope is now manageable. Because I thought, I'm cured. This is amazing. But the adrenaline started to wear off because I was doing a lot of gigs. And I look back at the videos and how confident I was and how much I was enjoying it. And I'm annoyed now that I didn't appreciate it at the time.
It's odd though, that, isn't it? Because there's not a huge amount of separation, because you're probably feeling the adrenaline either way. But it can be a fine line between the adrenaline being exciting and the adrenaline being terrifying. And I think a lot of it is, do you feel in control?
Yeah, the external view has become more important. It was all about my internal understanding of myself. I think getting out in front of people and ticking those boxes and feeling really confident as it's gone on, who I am and how I'm perceived by others has become more pressing. And it's a weird old thing to be more experienced than I've ever been, but more nervous.
It's strange that, isn't it? But I guess from the experiences you'd had and the fear that had built up, the fact that you'd gone up on stage a few times and you'd survived must have just been so exhilarating. Whereas now you maybe take for granted how much better you are at managing that fear and the anxiety. But in its place, there's a different kind of expectation now. So maybe you're not expecting that you're going to panic on stage or freeze or whatever else you might have been fearing. But instead it's, now I've got a bit of a reputation. Yeah. Now I've got to uphold this. Now I'm a funny person in the public eye.
I think it's redrawing the line of what's normal as well. Because I guess I got so used to being so out of sync with other people's stress and nerves before a big event that I don't know what the thing that I'm sliding back into my old ways. When actually, any normal, mentally balanced person that's never really had to delve into their psyche, maybe that's the level they'd be at. because they have to do like a best man speech or something. And maybe I'm overcomplicating it because I just don't know what a normal level of nervous excitement is, because I've never experienced it normally.
So, right, and it's different for everyone as well, right? So that just complicates it even further. But I guess that's one of the traps of many areas of mental health, right? That we want to find some kind of perfect, and there isn't, you know, there's better for us. Like, if I can get better at managing my mental health each year than the last one, you know, maybe there'll be a year that's worse. But if I can over time see a progression, I think that's enough, right?
I hope so.
That's got to be, yeah, please, that's got to be good enough.
It's amazing, though, because it is that conversation stuff when you say you're doing stand-up, that people, again, and considering I knew what I was like, presented as a confident person, the people who are really senior, who I've seen absolutely storm 100 people room presentations, taking me to one side going, I don't know how you do that. Because for them, what gets them on stage is being word perfect, practice, notes. And when you're a stand-up comedian, you're writing all your own stuff and you're speaking of your own experiences. So if people don't like it, it's like they don't like you. Whereas for corporate speakers, I guess, if they don't like the material, maybe it's a boring subject.
No, I guess that makes sense. And
blown away by like leaders of industry saying, I couldn't do what you do. It's like, I've just seen you headline a conference with thousands of delegates and you're telling me you couldn't go to my local pub and stand in front of 15 uninterested people and tell a story about how you fell down an Italian toilet once. Like, really? Because I think you could.
It's but funny, yeah, that, isn't it, the weird perceptions we can have, and how, you know, it can really mar truth at times, and it can make it so much more difficult for us to connect. You know, people want simple answers sometimes. People want us to fit into boxes, but that in many ways is part of the problem, right? Part of why we feel self-conscious. One thing I wanted to ask you about is, you mentioned feeling self-conscious about your appearance as part of this.
Absolutely. I'm very much somebody, and you know, I think there's a lot of it about, particularly, and everyone goes to town on things like filters and selfies. It's never been easier to control your own image to a degree. Like, if people who've never met you in real life or people haven't seen you for a while, I got used to being the one that took the photos because I hated how I was photographed. I hated being assaulted by a photograph where I didn't look how I looked in my head, or if it was a bad angle, I'd fixate on it. I was always in control of my own image. I wasn't on videos. I made an active choice. I was always the photographer because I've struggled with the disordered eating behaviors for a long, long time. It's something that was ingrained. And I think, I hope I'm one of the dwindling generations that is going to have felt this acutely from very young. Because I think I mentioned earlier, my mum was very much of the school, and well-meaningly of the school, that slimmer people just did better in life. They had an easier time of it. And she was dieting from as long as I could remember. I did the cabbage soup diet when I was 14 with her. And you look back now and it's like, that is not the kind of mentality that I would want to inflict on 13, 14-year-olds. The Special K adverts were nuts. When you look back at that, that was national TV telling you to eat cereal for breakfast and lunch and then have a salad for dinner. And we all went, yeah, I want to fit in that red swimsuit. That's completely fine. Like, that was how I grew up. Everything was
it
very
is incredible, isn't it? Focused. And I think because it's so prevalent, we buy into it. So even when that, it doesn't make any sense. And that is, from what I know, actually quite a sugary cereal.
Yeah, there's no nutritional value in this. It's just,
yeah,
calorie control cardboard flakes, basically.
but that's it. We can buy into it because it's so widespread. And, you know, an example that I think of with this is how almost every one of us knows somebody who's been on a diet on and off for their whole life.
Yeah, I'm one of those people.
Right, and it doesn't seem to work for them because body image perfection doesn't really exist. So even if they hit their own targets, the media they consume still tells them they're wrong.
Yeah, because the issue I've got with dieting clubs where you are weighed every week and you sit in a circle and talk about everything that you've done, everything you put in your mouth, what you're going to do, how to tackle making life taste nice. I've gone to those groups and I've lost weight on them. but a great psychological cost, because as soon as I started considering good foods, bad foods, sins, it's really hard to break out of that cycle. Like, I still use, there are products that I won't touch because they were too high a sort of sin count or point count. And nobody asked these women in the group, and I became more and more aware of it as I was going along. Nobody ever asked these women why they thought their target weight was going to change their life, because that was the goal. The goal was never, I want to be more active for my grandchildren. When you spoke to those people in the circle, it was never with a view to what you do next. And I kind of understand it if there was an ambition they wanted to fulfill, or if they wanted to do sport. The end game was reduction. You were smaller. You were reduced. It was a dress you wanted to fit into. And I think I would have spent my whole life, had I not been forced to confront this and do the thing that Mark Watson set me on that path, had I not been forced to confront this, I might have done the same. I might have waited until I was, in my head, looking like the kind of comedians you see on TV, because they're the kind of people that the media are interested in. I didn't want to walk into a place, because I spent years and years inadvertently judging my size versus everybody else's, and it's tiring and it's boring. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be walking into a place and going, well, all these women are thinner and prettier than me, I shouldn't be here. And somehow managed to push through it, and I found a place. And one of the things that I was surprised by, because I still on impulse will hate videos and photos where I've been caught unawares, or I don't, my inside head doesn't match what I can see outside. And what I was surprised by is, in a video I particularly hate, because I, as far as I'm concerned, I look terrible in it, how happy I looked doing it, all the different expressions that I had on my face and how expressive I was and how much other people were loving it. And I was able to, that was quite early on, because I was having to look at these videos to look at the material to understand how it could be better. So I was putting myself through it. But I was finding these little grains of something to feel happy about. It's like, oh, I look really happy and animated and friendly when I'm telling that joke. And I was able to take something positive beyond that. I was doing comedy and people seemed to like it. And it sort of started hopefully rehabilitating how much worth I put on what I look like and what I look like in my own head. So I'm like, I've got a funhouse mirror in my head. I can wake up one day and think I look amazing and wake up the next day and be appalled. And it's depressing for me, because I've got, you know, I really buy into, like, you see beautiful plus size models and I think they look incredible. And I mean it with my whole heart. When I see bigger women looking beautiful, I love it and I'm thrilled by it. And I don't think that's a fat woman. I think that is a cool woman looking gorgeous. I can't seem to apply it to myself. And I find that really hard, because I consider myself quite a progressive thinker. I consider myself quite an inclusive thinker, but I can't seem to get away from the notion that life would be better for me if I was smaller. I don't want that for anybody else. I don't think that about anybody else. I don't like to think that I'm prejudiced against anybody's size, whether they're thin or fat. They're just descriptives. And I'm trying to use fat in a more positive way as well, because I used to be really scared to say it to people, because it was a term that was very loaded. So I'll say it now, like, I'm trying
what, so you to mean being even
a,
describe
a fatter person? Yeah, because I am, you know, I know what I weigh. I know what I look like, but that's fine. Like, I love dressing up, I look nice in clothes, my husband thinks I'm gorgeous, my friends think I'm gorgeous. I don't know what it is in my head that I can't maintain this. I can't maintain this view that when things go wrong or when I see a bad photo, I want to look smaller. I don't understand it. And I find it confusing, but I am trying to change. I've read Sophie Hagen's book, Happy Fat. One of those things, it's like, just start using it as a descriptive. Fat doesn't mean ugly. It is just descriptive. Nobody's upset when you call someone like petite or tall, in the way that as soon as you start talking about fat and thin, there are connotations to it. And it's a work in progress. But,
right, and it's just so subjective,
yeah,
right, that we somehow accept that small is a compliment to most people if you're a woman, but it's not if you're a man. Yeah. How have we got these really complicated meanings behind what are just words? And a lot of it is,
it's so binary. It's, yeah, and it's, we're kind so much of more than those preset binaries. That, yeah, I hope, like I said, I hope I'm one of the last generations that will have this almost preloaded from being a child. And I know a lot of people say social media is a problem, but I didn't have social media and I still got it imprinted on me. I like that there's a conversation going on. I like that there's some empowerment and there's a little bit more freedom to sort of take up the space that you want to take up.
And I think it parallels for me a lot with mental health stigma, how just the act of talking about it can expose how little this stuff makes sense. Like you've even described there, one of the kind of crazy mental backflips that on one hand you've described in the past, you know, this automated thing you built up where every time you went into a room, you would assess who's the biggest woman in the room. You know, that's how ingrained it got for you. And that awareness and thinking, okay, everyone's going to see my size and judge me for it. And yet at the same time, I've heard people talk about using the word fat like an admission. But if you think everybody is only seeing you as fat, then how would it be an admission? But it's because we don't talk about this stuff. We get all these conflicts. It's like you lose in every version of it somehow, even though that doesn't actually add up.
Because people are affronted when I describe myself as fat, because we are programmed to go, you're not fat, you're beautiful. Or like both those things can be true. But you will see particularly women who have all been conditioned the same to immediately sweep in and disagree with you. And like I said, I know my size. I know what I look like. I know what I weigh. It's okay. We can acknowledge it. There are other parts of me that make up me. That's just one tiny element. And when I was, the thing about the comparison, when I was comparing myself, it wasn't to find the biggest person in the room. It was thoroughly centered on me. Like always. If there were other plus size people there, I'd sort of feel a bit more comfortable. Whereas if everybody was slim and I was by far the biggest person in the room, like it was never malicious to other people. It was very self-absorbed almost. It's like, what is my place in this room? Which is quite an odd, it's like I said, it's really tiring. Like I have never picked a sandwich based entirely on what I want. Because forever, for as long as I can remember, I've looked at the calories in sandwiches. And if they're over 500, for whatever reason, even if it sounded like the most delicious thing in the world, I will disregard a 500 calorie plus sandwich. I don't know when that started and I don't really know how to fix it. It's just a weird thing. Like I know all the calories and things. What a waste of space. What brilliant thoughts would I be thinking if I didn't have that taking a sandwich? So something that I want to do more work on. And I described myself as fat on my own podcast recently. And the three guests didn't acknowledge it. It was great. And it was a moment where I messaged somebody about it and was like, that was actually a really empowering moment. Nobody swept in to say, no, you're not. Nobody thought anything negative. They just heard a descriptive. It was how Ishan Akbar said he had a problem as a comedian because any comedians that broadly matched him by race, he would just get lumped into the same box as. So it's like, oh, yeah, you and, you know, like he could be like, oh, you're like Nish Kumar. He's like, our company's not the same. But our skin color is vaguely similar. So I get boxed into this category. And I said, it's the same for me. I have been boxed into category of like fat female comedians. And everyone just, the conversation carried on. And it felt like a real moment for me. And I was surprised that I said it. But I loved that the response was just, yeah, it sucks. You're a comedian on your own terms. You're not Rebel Wilson. You're not anybody else. That's, it was just a part of the conversation. It felt like a massive step forward. And it was a really tiny thing, but something I took away and I went, maybe one day I'm going to be all right with this.
Oh, that's so lovely to hear. But you're right. It can be so validating. And I think that conversation is maybe in the very early stages. Whereas I think people would understand, you know, with me, for example, I'm 6'3". And so I will describe myself as tall. You know, that is an obvious descriptor about me. And if I said that and someone turned around and said, you're not, I would be offended. You know, not even that it's about the value I hold in height, just in the, no, this is part of my experience of life and how people perceive me. So it's like we can instantly understand it in that context. And yet we've got this completely warped view when it comes to body size. It's absolute madness. And we've still got a long way to go in terms of getting away from the somebody losing weight and people thinking, oh, that's automatically wonderful.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, and you look so well. No, you're saying I look thin. I've actually gone, like, whenever I've been my slimmest is when I've been at my absolute darkest, like the worst times. And the, you know, the slimness has come at a cost. So it's something that I'm quite careful not to, because I know that's kind of praise when you're in that kind of place is not helpful. So, looking back at photos now, I'm like, would I like to look like that again? Probably. Would I like to be in that mental place again that got me there? Not so
but
much.
It's so great that you can make that distinction, right? Because I've seen it firsthand with people I know where they've had the same thing. You know, what times have they been at their thinnest? Maybe they look at a picture of them after they were bereaved and they look at the picture and think how horrible it is. But I really look good at that size. And I'm like, wow. The fact that it'll get in so deep that it somehow is big enough to compete with the monumental grief you can remember from seeing yourself in a funeral outfit. It's that extreme.
But that's the thing you think of. It's not, yeah.
And it can deny your experience so much, right? That this narrative exists and that binary thing that you've said, it very much applies, you know, if somebody's thin because of mental illness or if someone's put on weight because of mental illness, deciding what that is for them can be, I think, just as confronting as if someone's turned around to me, like many people have, and said, oh, but you don't seem depressed.
Yeah, I know. I've come up with a variety of coping mechanisms for it. I think I never get too far down that path anymore because I got really into going to the gym and I probably didn't lose much weight. But in my mind, psychologically, I was doing something for myself that was healthy, that was definitely not bad for me. And I was creating this space and I went to the gym. I've got that kind of addictive personality. So I couldn't just go to the gym once or twice a week. I did a year where I went like every day, sometimes twice, but that balanced the book to me. So whenever I felt that I wasn't my most confident, that was something that I could do that wasn't restricting calories or grinding myself into the ground feeling inadequate. It was something that I could actively do that was towards that goal, that wasn't dangerous for me, that was healthy.
Yeah.
And it's been hard in lockdown not having that outlet. So it's never about, I think it's ever about the weight end game for me. It's all about feeling in control of it.
And it makes such a difference, doesn't it, what the aim is. You know, even as simple as maybe rather than a weight goal, you have a goal of, I want to be able to lift this weight. You know, let's focus on that weight rather than the weight of you. You know, it can
I want to run further. I want to be able to go up flights of stairs and feel like...
Because like after all, that's what health actually is.
Yeah.
And we can lose sight of that. But I want to pivot back to public speaking because I understand how linked this is for you. And I think a lot of what we've discussed, many of the listeners will relate to. So what tips would you have if people are connecting with your experience of both overcoming the physical self-consciousness, but also the internal panic that can build up about public speaking?
The public speaking thing, the best thing that I ever registered, and it's something that has seen me through many, many times, nobody knows what you are supposed to say but you. And particularly with stand-up comedy, unless you give it away, nobody knew that that was the punchline, unless you pause at the end and look absolutely heartbroken that no one's gone with it. You just carry on. Do your 5 minutes. If no one's laughing at anything, just carry on. And I think it's the same with any kind of public speaking. If you fluff a line or if you go off script and you find yourself somewhere else, nobody knows what you've got written down. And you need to remember that. So it's just about keeping it cool. Like, no one knows what you were supposed to do. And that is quite liberating.
Yeah.
No one's holding you to account. And when you think about people you've seen speak, nobody remembers the bits where people have grappled it or dropped the ball because you want the speaker to be good. Most people are nice, lovely people that just want the best for you. No one's waiting for you to trip up. And if you do trip up, everybody is ready to pick you up or just pretend it didn't happen. Like, people are good on the whole. So the pressure that you put on yourself is you're putting it on yourself. And I think that's something that I really had to learn. And it's come in very useful at jokes that haven't landed. And it's like, do you know what? I'm just going to pretend that was set up. You don't need to know that there was supposed to be a laugh there. So, which has been probably the biggest thing. Take the first step as well. Like I said, Sophie Hagen, their advice stuck with me to get me to that first session. Just go to the door. If it's, you know, something that you want to sign up for, sign up for the first bit. You can always pull out. There aren't many things that aren't reversible. So just take it in small steps and don't punish yourself too hard if you have felt a physical response for it. Because like I said, I reached a point where I didn't realize what normal nerves felt like. So I didn't know if what I was experiencing would be what anyone in my scenario was experiencing. So I kind of lost perspective, and it helps to sometimes speak to other people about things like that. Because like I said, with those corporate speakers, I was astonished that they were impressed by my stand-up stuff. Everybody thinks that public speaking is a big psychological jump, and everybody acknowledges that. So just by getting on the mic, you've earned people's respect. And I think that's something that I wasn't really taken into account either, because I felt that when people got up to speak, I was like, yeah, go you. This is something that I'm really scared of. And most people are quite frightened of public speaking to some degree, even if it's just a niggle. So people are already willing you on if you're brave enough to take that first step. So
yes, absolutely.
But I found out very late in life. I wish I'd done it earlier, but I'm not sure I was psychologically ready for it earlier. I'm glad that I'm doing comedy now. So I started when I was 35, and I'm not sure who I was in my 20s. I was very fragile. I was prone to these deep depressions and very, very disordered in my approach to food and dysmorphic. I don't think I was ready for it then. So as much as I'm disappointed that I haven't been doing this for years, because it's something that has unlocked something I didn't realize I had in me, and it's a true love of my life now. It might not have been. It might have gone horribly if I tried to push myself before I'd done the work to get to where I am. So.
Yes, and with that in mind, I'll give two things that have helped me that can be used at different levels. So in terms of public speaking, where if you over-prepare and over-script it, then you saying a sentence differently could throw the rest of your presentation. But at the same time, you don't want to do no preparation. So for me now, my preparation for public speaking, where it's not a conversation, where it's just me and some slides, is I sit and I talk to myself. I just go through the slides and I kind of casually go through the structure. And then when I get on stage, I know the order, but I haven't put that pressure of here's the ideal way to say everything. Because actually the ideal way is be present with the audience. If someone laughs and you didn't expect them to laugh at that point, pause, continue. A laugh is a good thing. That can't throw you. And then the other thing I'd say, it's been really helpful to learn how much people love familiarity. And you made me think of this example with the idea of going around the room and the fact that you were in such a intense mental space that you couldn't remember what the previous person had said. And I've learned that there's such power in showing that you're listening. You could make the cheesiest joke. There could have been three Chris's sat next to you. And if you said, hi, I'm not called Chris, but my name's nearly Chris, it's Vix. People would probably laugh at that just because it's sort of like, oh, they're called Chris, she is. Like, it can be the silliest thing, but it's the familiarity that releases the tension that makes people laugh.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love that. And that's why we see in comedy so often people reference an earlier joke and they keep coming back to it, right? Or it can be great if you go up to do a speech and you say, you know, it's kind of warm in here. Or, you know, what about that light flickering in the corner? Completely irrelevant, but everyone's like, that light is flickering in the corner. Ha ha ha.
Yeah. We've experienced this together. We're a team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so they're the two that I've found most helpful. But thank you so much for joining me. It's been lovely chatting to you, and it's so incredible to see what you're up to. You started comedy fairly near to the pandemic kicking off. So, bit of a baptism of fire, but I'm so excited to see what you do. And even just your podcasting alone, you're doing so many great things in lockdown.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on. I enjoyed preparing for this, to make sure that I hopefully could make the kind of points that resonated because I've listened to a few of your podcasts and I know what I got from them. So I just wanted to make sure that I had something that hopefully people could take away and relate to and find useful. So it's been a really nice opportunity for me to review what I've done. So thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Of course. And I'm going to answer on behalf of the listeners. You definitely made some stellar points. So thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.